Susie Towes was 18 years old when she ventured out of her little English village of Beverley south to London, a distance of more than 200 miles.
I remember packing a little case. I can't remember if I purchased the ticket for the train or whether there were two trains involved in that journey, but everything was a lot longer in those days, the roads down to London and the train service, the old steam trains. But I do remember when I was heading down there that it was a bit of a long day. And as the train, I remember the train pulling in to the King's Cross station in London. It was very large. I'd not been to a big city like this before, and especially London. I'd never travelled alone. But as the train chugged in and the horns tooted and the steam poured out of the engine, the porter was soon there to open all the doors, and then everyone was allowed to dismantle from the train. I noticed that there were large crowds of people on the platform, and I was amazed at seeing so many people. However, my turn soon came to get down from the train. I wondered how they would be able to find me in all this crowd of people. So I started to walk towards the barrier of the exit of the station to see if I could meet with anyone. Holding my case up, I had attached beforehand a large sheet of paper with the letters LDS, so that anyone who saw me would know I was Latter-day Saint and I would be with the right company when I did get claimed. Sure enough, two very mature elderly gentlemen came up smiling, and the first thing I noticed was the American accent and knew that this was the safe person to be with.
Susie had joined the church 2 years before and was now coming to London for an interview to serve a mission in the offices of the Building Mission. The Building Mission program used missionaries, many of whom were recent converts like Susie, to help construct chapels and other church buildings in response to the explosion of members in the United Kingdom during the 1960s.
Although these missionaries didn't preach the gospel with words, their efforts helped give saints in the British Isles permanent places to worship and strengthen their testimonies, a sign of new permanence in the church in a country where so many early converts had left to come west to Zion. Such programs were running in many other countries as the church sought to provide better facilities for its members. This is Saints, Volume 4, the podcast. I'm Lisa Christensen.
And I'm James Perry. Building missionaries in the British Isles. Church membership was booming in the British Isles during the 1960s, especially among young people who flocked to activities in the Mutual Improvement Association, or MIA, the precursor to today's Young Men and Young Women programs. That was certainly true of Beverley, a small town in East Yorkshire that could trace its history back centuries to when it was a medieval market town. But church buildings to hold all of its members, new and old, were in much scarcer supply in Beverley.
It was predominantly Church of England, Catholic. So a lot of people were reluctant to let you use the halls. But we did end up in a school, I remember once, that I had attended, and they had plenty of classrooms when we did get a Sunday school going. And there were often maybe hotels. I remember a room, the top of a hotel, and we still had to clear everything from the events that had been there before and put out the seating for meetings. So, and then they started the sacrament meeting, so they needed maybe two venues. They weren't always in the same place every meeting. It would be announced the week before, and there was always some youth. It was mainly youth then, I must stress. We never had much priesthood, in fact, hardly one at all. And they would pass the message on, are you coming to sacrament this week? It's at so-and-so, which usually lasted a while once they booked it, because the members at sacrament were a lot quieter than the MIA people. So that was how the messages got round, really. And people were in contact with the elders then. They would have weekly firesides where they popped the American popcorn in a frying pan. And I remember that quite vividly, attending the firesides where they would then at the end give a lesson.
Church leaders saw the need to build chapels to give members and missionaries a permanent place to worship, and also to show the permanence of the church in England, which had been reduced to scattered congregations during the 19th century when new converts everywhere were urged to gather and strengthen the church in the Western United States. But some places were reluctant to give space to this religion, which many viewed as American and cultish. In Beverly, even after the church bought land to build a chapel on, the local government was reluctant to issue the necessary permits, and nearby sellers of wood and other construction supplies declined to sell to church members.
Elder Bill Strible, a volunteer church building supervisor, worked hard to reassure residents in Beverly of the church's sincerity in seeking a place to worship, and his efforts paid off. Jeffrey Dunning, another young member from that time, remembers working with Elder Strible.
He was a convert to the church and not too many years previous to his being sent to build our church in England. He understood how a local community could feel, him being not a member of the church for so long. So he was just a nice guy, not pushy, Canadian, and he was able to very humbly and quietly foster very good relationships with many, many people in the town, with the suppliers, and eventually with the public that used to drop in occasionally and see what was going on. I was just a new convert, so he kind of took me under his wing. His family took me under his wing and used to have me over for meals and just watch over me and give me counsel.
Before Jeff joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, he was one of those members of the public who would drop in to see what was going on. A group of building missionaries had been sent to work on the building, and members brought their spades, hammers, and saws to help. Every day of the week but Sunday, the chapel would progress a little more, and the Beverly townspeople, including Jeff, noticed.
I was making my daily journey from Beverly to our family farm at a nearby village called Lund. On one particular day, I noticed that some hedgerow had been pulled out of a field, and a large sign had been erected in its place, which read, "The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." I was driving past with my father, and I remember saying to him, "What on earth do we need another church in Beverly for? There is hardly anyone attending the ones we have."
Just 6 weeks later, he began dating a young woman who was a member, and because of his connection with her, he began learning of the church. This new girlfriend was also a friend of Susie's, and both the girls were on the fellowshipping committees of the branch. Although Jeff's romance didn't last, his interest in the church did. Jeff went to the house of an elderly member, Emma Harper, to meet with missionaries and learn about the gospel. 6 weeks after that, he was baptized in a nearby river. Later, he, too, was placed on the fellowshipping committee, of which Susie was a part.
Susie helped to build the chapel where and when she could, but it was when she saw an ad on the notice board asking for missionaries to help in the building office that she got her big opportunity to serve. She had previously taken shorthand and typing classes and had been working as a personal secretary at a local construction firm. During that trip to London, she passed her interview with flying colors and was soon assigned to be secretary to the assistant supervisor of the building program.
I was quite thrilled because I had been working as a personal secretary before, and I knew that I would enjoy this and working with all the church leaders and people who had been in the church a long time, that I would be able to see how the church really was for those that had been living it many years. We had seminars and other things that I was able to see to the programs and also help with accommodation. I often met with church leaders and people that were coming over as new supervisors on the buildings would come into the offices and they would come into the construction department. There was quite a lot of variety.
Susie's duties also included attending the dedications for each new building and then taking detailed shorthand notes that she would later transcribe and send to archivists in Salt Lake City. Perhaps the most memorable of these during Susie's mission was the dedication of the chapel in Merthyr Tydfil, Wales. President David O. Mackay's mother had been Welsh, so in August 1963, the prophet himself travelled to Wales to dedicate the new building.
Before he arrived at the chapel that day, they had everyone already in their seats inside to avoid crowds outside. He was elderly, was President Mackay, and they didn't want him surrounded by people at his entry. Now, I happened to be outside with a few other missionaries, and President Mackay walked up alongside of us towards the chapel doors. This event was 60 years ago, but I can still picture the scene and the wonderful feeling that overpowered me. There was a great love and peace that emitted from him. Everyone later said to me, Didn't you shake his hand? No, I was so overcome. I was enveloped in a most wonderful spirit, and time stood still around me. I was a big record keeper after my mission. It taught me to keep records of all kinds. And I have this account that I'll read. I was so blessed to have the opportunity to take his photo outside the chapel with the other few missionaries and be near enough to feel his presence. As he arrived and walked up the pathway to the chapel doors, I stopped taking photos of him. I was so taken up in awe at the strong positive feeling of peace and love that emitted from him. This great feeling of love filled my whole soul and was an extremely tangible experience. Never had I ever experienced anything so powerful, a true witness that he was a man of God, one who had a great love for mankind, indeed a prophet of God. Now, President McKay's mother was Welsh, and during the service in the chapel, the prophet shed tears as he spoke, and the members of the church that were tightly crowded into the chapel were moved greatly by his words. Just to look into his face was a testimony, and no doubt could there be that he is a true prophet inspired of God to lead the church. Now, I have a note underneath this that I have recalled since. I do recall after 60 years that on that day, 25th of August 1963, and the 26th of August, the dedications, that the Welsh choir sang a song in their own language, welcoming him, which sounded extremely beautiful. Their voices were rich and harmonious, like angels from heaven. The strength and spirit these Welsh singers added to that service brought tears to the eyes of the large congregation there, as well as the prophets. Indeed, to this day, as I recall and picture in my mind that dedication event, the presence of our beloved prophet David O. McKay and the glorious words and music of that Welsh choir, which filled the room with a very holy spirit, I can hardly hold back tears as my heart feels once again the overpowering love that was present there.
Susie's duties included taking notes during meetings with each of the four district supervisors who would come from their areas around the United Kingdom and typing up dictated letters from her bosses. Aside from her secretarial duties, she woke early to study scriptures and pray as other missionaries did. Sometimes, the building mission headquarters would receive visits from general authorities. Susie would often take notes of the talks she heard from these speakers, but in this case, these notes were for her personal use.
All the learning that I got in the classes the elders taught, and anything in between, I wanted to send to Jeff, who was a new convert of 1 year in our branch when I left for my mission. So I decided to send him, as I told him, all the learning, we called it, that we had gained each week, and that he would also send me quotes or articles. With that, I bought Jeff a new set of scriptures with his name emboldened on the cover. He began at once to read the Book of Mormon, getting up early each day before work on the farm. I know that this definitely helped Jeff get a firm foothold in the gospel in those early years in the church.
Back in Beverly, Jeff was working hard to build his testimony, just as he was to build the chapel. Jeff's family ran a farm, and he was able to use equipment from his family's farm to help with construction of the Beverly Chapel.
Initially, we were digging a lot of trenches for the foundations, and then we started getting involved in other tasks in the building itself. And I mean, all tasks relative to building a structure. As members, we weren't necessarily required to do some of the rather dangerous things that the young building missionaries were being asked to do, and often without any scaffolding in those days, you know, climbing up on the beams and so forth. I was able to bring my farm tractor and help with backfilling the foundations. Later on, it was my farm tractor that was used to level the ground in preparation for the lawns. Elder Strible made a wooden structure with some large planks that I towed around with my tractor, and it levelled the ground, and it did a really good job, actually.
There were, however, some tensions within his family since joining the church, especially when harvest time came around and Jeff insisted on keeping the Sabbath holy. During this time, Jeff also taught his mother the gospel, and she joined the church too, giving up drinking tea to keep the word of wisdom. Susie's family had also allowed her to join the church, but had been upset at her serving a mission.
At one point, Susie's mother wrote to her and told her that if she didn't come home from her mission right away, there would be no place for her to come home to. Susie's mission president urged her to stay the course and that the Lord would provide a way for Susie to return home and smooth over her relationship with her family. She agreed. She had other concerns, too. Over the course of her mission, her letters to Jeff had remained spiritual, but they'd also become more personal. Susie had come home briefly for her first Christmas after entering the mission field, and at a holiday branch activity, the two found a spark between them they hadn't noticed before. When Susie went back to London after the new year, their correspondence went from weekly letters to daily ones. The whole office, and beyond, noticed the romance blossoming through the postal system.
This became to a point where Jeff proposed to me, and he sent an eternity ring, because he said it was for eternity, and it wouldn't be too big on my finger, being a typist on the old-fashioned typewriters. He sent this ring through the mailing system. The postman, who was completely familiar of our love for each other because of the number of letters I received from Jeff, he recognised that the small box Jeff had sent would contain a ring, and he refused to hand it to me that morning without him being proxy for Jeff. No amount of persuasion would deter him. This postman, Jeff had nicknamed him Blondie because he had blonde hair, and Jeff would often write notes on the back of the envelopes regarding him. The postman therefore knelt on the grass outside the church apartments and, putting the ring on my finger, acting as proxy for Jeff, he asked me to marry him. This was watched by an audience of missionary girls from the church offices as we were all leaving to go for our daily work there, who thought it to be hilarious, but a very tender scene. The postman was knelt down, the ring was put on my finger. The postman was quite delighted as he went on his way to deliver the mail around the area.
Susie returned the next holiday season as a bride-to-be. In the meantime, Jeff had thoroughly won over Susie's parents, and Jeff's mother had reached out a friendly hand to Susie's mother. Just as Susie's mission president had promised, her family welcomed her back home. Although they were still less than thrilled that she was a member of the church, and her mother initially threatened to boycott the wedding because it was going to be held in the newly completed Beverly Chapel, she came around. She was well known in the community for her flower arrangements, and she decorated the hall for the wedding reception. In March 1965, 10 weeks after Susie returned from her mission, Susie and Jeff were married.
We were the second couple to be married in the chapel, but we were the first couple from Beverly Branch to be married in it. And then we were sealed in the London Temple by Eugene England, the London England Temple President, on the Saturday following. A large number of the church building department staff attended this event also. They also attended my endowment prior to the sealing. This was the rule in the early 1960s, that the marriage had to be done in the chapels to fulfil the law, and that the bride could not be endowed until the day of the sealing in the temple, which had to be the Saturday following the chapel marriage. So it was quite a long event on that day, and I well remember photographs being taken outside with some of the staff. It was quite a delightful time for them to watch one of their young ladies attend and marry in the temple to be sealed after fulfilling her mission, and to have a young man that they had already become to know through Jeff's letters, through the ring that I showed them in the offices that day. And so they were quite excited, having watched the progress of how we got together and completed the mission and were married.
Susie's family became closer to her as the couple moved into a little house Jeff bought, and as they grew their family with 4 children. Early in their marriage, Susie took another job as a secretary and then used her skills again years later to support Jeff in his leadership positions within the National Farmers Union. She also helped with the difficult work of the farm, and the Dunnings had their children take piano lessons so all 4 of them could provide music for meetings. The branch was still small and grew slowly, but the Dunnings worked as hard to strengthen and grow it as they had serving a mission and building the chapel.
We had very many happy years. We had members come to our farm for bonfire nights and other events. We put on refreshments, barn dances. with a proper barn dancing group we had from members in York that came.
Jeff was called to serve in the branch presidency just a year after joining the church, and was called to be branch president 3 times after that. Both Susie and Jeff have held multiple church callings, jobs, and worked in community endeavors. But through it all, they have prioritized family, faith, and each other.
He always says, we make a good team, which is true. I have always gone the extra mile in supporting him in all his church callings, with his community work, managing my own callings and family responsibilities also. And we have worked on many things together throughout our years.
I joined the church as a young man of 18. I was at a point in my life when I needed guidance and direction in many ways. I would simply say that whatever I amount to now, I owe to my membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and to my wife, Suzette, and of course to the parents that raised me. And I am eternally grateful that I was brought into this church, and I believe through the prayers of my mother that I met the missionaries and received the blessings of the gospel in my life.
The Beverly branch has grown since the 1960s. In 1973, the whole district, of which Beverly was a part, became a stake, and the branch became a ward. Susie and Jeff have seen their congregation grow, and the people around them grow too. It's been 60 years since they were anxiously engaged in their respective efforts to build the kingdom of heaven more literally than the phrase is typically used. But their memories of those days and the lessons they learned remain sharp.
It was just such a special time. It was a wonderful time to be part of the church. It was so exciting, and it was so unifying because we had a common purpose. You know, like they say, a wartime brings people together. Well, this was our common purpose to get this church constructed, and it created unity. It helped young converts find a place in the church, and it's just a wonderful time. It was a wonderful program. Can't speak too highly of it.
Also, the young missionary boys working on the sites developed skills that many of them used to make a living for the rest of their lives. The building missionary boys were a great strength and example to the local youth too, helping to keep them active in the church. They were taken into people's homes in the branches they went to, where the chapels were being built, and the members looked after them. They became responsible leaders, all of us did, both young men and young women, with strong testimonies emerging from this church building program. We were able to return to our branches and take up major callings to support the church growth in Britain in the 1960s. I remember seeing a magazine with this written on the front that someone in the church building program wrote. It was also had other verses, and it was sung at one of the church building conferences one year on the stage. A building towers to the sky, a building bold with mighty steeple. This building's strength came through our hands. As we built churches, we built people.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Saints Volume 4. We hope you come away with new insights, perspectives, and appreciation for the history of the church. If you'd like to share those thoughts, we'd love to hear from you at saintspodcast@churchofjesuschrist.org.